I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Rob started the company in 2005 while he was 25 years old, and Etsy has more than 1 million artisans who sell their items on the site. Welcome.
Thank you.
So prior to starting Etsy, you were living in Brooklyn. You were a woodworker and furniture designer. What kind of furniture and woodworking did you do?
I was doing a lot of different stuff. I had a line of what I called 2x furniture, where I was using 2x4s and using some intricate joinery and making these rustic-looking tables. And prior to that, had taken this long path of just doing everything from demolition to sheetrocking, so learning my materials.
How did you first get introduced to woodworking and working with your hands?
Through my dad, who he started his own company in architectural specifications when I was growing up, and he was the person who picked what materials things were made out of, so all these companies would always send him free materials to try and encourage him to specify them in the buildings. And so I just grew up with tons of free samples of tile, and I remember a piece of bulletproof glass with a bullet shot in it, and was making things out of it. And then combine that with the kind of natural curiosity and desire for self-reliance, and you just basically start making things.
You mentioned self-reliance. Was that the culture of your family growing up, where that you would make a lot of the things that you would use?
I think that actually grew out of this idea of laissez-faire parenting that leads to self-reliance, because my parents just kind of let me go. And lacking that direction, you realize you can create that direction for yourself.
Did your parents consciously want you to just have the freedom to do what you wanted, or they were distracted by other things that might have caused that laissez-faire approach?
I would love to ask my parents that question. My dad was at work a lot, and I didn't see him all that much. I don't know. A lot of the schooling that I went to was just standard public schooling, and I really couldn't fit into that. And so I was challenged at a really young age with either getting kicked out of class all the time or trying to make something hold my attention. And that type of process led me to see the world as I wanted to see it. So I would try and change it to fit me because I knew I couldn't fit into it. And that led, you know, when I was older, to seeing psychiatrists and getting prescribed, you know, Adderall and things like that, which never interested me.
What's an example of things that you tried to change to fit or be more aligned with yourself?
Sitting in a desk with a textbook in front of you was something was very difficult for me, so I would ask the teacher if I could, you know, sit on the radiator. I remember this from like 6th, 7th grade, going back even earlier.
What did they say?
Some of them would say yes.
So what are other examples? What else?
Not being able to keep my mouth shut, getting kicked out of class. I remember being really young, and I'd gotten kicked out of class, and I was standing in the hallway, and the principal walked by. And this is in elementary school, and I still remember this so clearly. And he said, "What are you doing out in the hallway?" And I really quickly said, "We're playing a game, and I'm supposed to be standing out here while they do something." And then I go back in and just kind of said, "Okay," and he kept walking.
And what part of all of this existing outside the mold was just kind of stimulating for you, and you kind of got a rise out of being a troublemaker?
I hope I wasn't trying to be a troublemaker. I hope it was just me being me. One of the things that's really difficult for me is I notice far too many things. Like, I see a lot, so it's always like I have this type of sensory overload and I have to choose what to focus on. And I've always thought attention deficit disorder is the exact opposite. It's more like attention excess disorder, where you're trying to pay attention to too many different things and then you can't focus.
You mentioned that your father worked in architecture. What about your mom?
My mom has been a teacher since I was really young, and more specifically teaching kids with behavioral disorders.
So how did she feel when she thought her kid had just that?
It was interesting. She kind of passed me off at one point to, you know, to the professionals to see, okay, well, you know, I remember being 16 in this pivotal moment of discovering photography and probably smoking pot for the first time, just really opening up these different paths to creativity for me. And, you know, at that point, I was going into the city and Boston all night and taking pictures at night. I was doing a lot of night photography, and I would come home and I would pass out. You know, the tea in Boston, the last tea is, you know, probably around midnight.
The tea being the subway.
Yeah. So I would go in on the last tea, and I would walk around, and then I would come back on the earliest one, come home, sleep for an hour, and go to school. And I would go to school, and sometimes just cut all my classes and go sleep in the photography room. And then I would come home from school, fall back asleep, and get ready for another night out. And all my mom saw of that part was me sleeping all the time. And so she said, well, you must be depressed.
So she said, you must be depressed. Did you feel depressed? Were you like, oh, she must be right, she's my mom? Or did you think, oh, she just doesn't know that I've been out?
When you're 16, I think you, by default, think everything your parents say is wrong anyways. So initial reaction wasn't to say she was right.
Sitting here with you, you seem a little bit soft-spoken and demure and well-behaved. It's hard to believe that you were kind of a miscreant or a maverick growing up. Have you always had this same disposition?
No. This has been a big change. And I remember, you know, nicknames from being a kid all had to do with me not being able to shut up or sit still. And there's a lot of patience that you learn in starting a business and working with other people. And it's also just adapting yourself to what's around. And I'll point out, this is a pretty quiet and demure place. Mm. So I feel that way. But yeah, when the company was just me and two engineers working out of my apartment, there was more screaming with those three people than there was in the company of 200 cumulatively across that entire company.
Your parents divorced when you were in high school, and you went to high school outside of Boston in Newton for 2 minutes, and then you dropped out.
I made it up to the beginning of my junior year and then just discovered photography and stopped going to classes. And also got a job. My mom dropped me off in town and said, don't come home until you have a job. And I was a cashier at Marshall's, was my very first job during the Christmas season. I think I was the only person under 60 working there. And that was a great experience, because I think a lot of how you learn what interests you is by learning what doesn't interest you. And getting that window opened really early on was helpful.
Did you feel unconditional love from your family while you were going through all this hardship?
No, there were times in there where, I mean, my parents' divorce was really tough for me, and there was a time where I wasn't really speaking with my mom, and I left home and went and lived with my uncle in South Boston. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was just me discovering who I was, and I think I was so intent on that exploration that I naturally cut my ties, you know, my really close ties with my parents there. Mm-hmm. And it's been a fun journey where you realize how you can get deep into something that you really care about and that can take you away from these other relationships that are really important. I saw my dad do this in my parents' marriage, where, you know, he focused on work to the point where, you know, my mom didn't feel loved. And I've definitely caught myself doing that with my work. You know, the girlfriend that I had when I started Etsy, you know, left me about probably 8 months into starting Etsy. And there's this balance, and you really have to decide what you care about and what matters most at that moment.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. So here you are in 2005, 25 years old, living in Brooklyn, trying to make a life being a woodworker, furniture designer. How did you come up with the idea for Etsy in that moment?
I graduated from college, my fifth college, and had that BA and kind of held it up and said, all right, well, time to go get a job. And seeing what doors that degree opened for me was a huge disappointment, where I saw people who were a year older than me who'd spent all of this time studying literature, and the jobs that they were getting were a notch above or alphabetizing filing cabinets at a publishing firm. And I wanted to do something that didn't waste this incredible education that I felt like I'd received and created for myself. And knew at that point that if I just went to work for some other big company, I wasn't going to be able to realize that. So started my own company with woodworking and said, okay, well, I'm going to make furniture. And I was making these couture computer cases. I was making wooden computer cases and looked for the best way to sell those, and looked on in the offline world. And there's consignment, there's wholesaling, and neither of those were really my cup of tea. I looked at the online world, and neither of those really worked out. And so that was on the back burner. And then the magical moment happened when I started working with Jean Rayla, who was the creator of Get Crafty. And she's an amazing person. I met her through a professor at NYU that I knew. I was starting a web development company as way to learn in one sense, where I didn't know anything about making websites, but I felt like there was something magical about that medium. And she asked me to help her rebuild Get Crafty. And that was my introduction to designing websites and then also building something that's helping communities organize and helping people communicate. And the community there was definitely crafters and a lot of them women who were doing their crafting as a hobby and looking to sell some of the stuff. And I was looking to sell my own furniture, and so that idea percolated, and I talked with Jean about adding a marketplace to Get Crafty, and she said, and I probably agree with her, that it would probably be better to start the marketplace separate instead of doing it inside of Get Crafty, because Get Crafty was really just a, you know, community of people talking. So one thing led to another, and the idea of creating the marketplace as a marketplace took birth.
What, by the way, was the name of your furniture company?
The same as the name of the marketplace. I actually still have my very first business cards where it says Etsy and there's a picture of this plywood table that I was designing on the card. I just found that when I was packing stuff up.
You came up with the name Etsy. It was inspired by a Fellini film called 8 and a Half. What's that story?
There's a scene where Guido's having a flashback to his childhood and there's a painting on the wall, and if you say this magic phrase, Asa Nisi Masa, the painting comes alive and looks at where this hidden treasure is. And so for me, it's just that idea of a magical nonsense word that when you utter it will reveal hidden treasures.
At what point did Etsy go from a vehicle for selling your furniture to your sole endeavor? Like, wow, I'm going to focus all my time on this and forget the furniture thing.
When I initially started Etsy, my thinking was I'll build the marketplace where I'd like to sell what I'm making, and then I'll get right back to making these things, and I just need the right venue to sell them. And another component to that was I was trying to set up my own e-commerce shop to sell what I was making on my own, and it was this lonely little website on the vast internet, and I'd seen the power of community working with Get Crafty, and there was another site called Craftster. And I wanted that community to bolster the marketplace. And, you know, I looked into things like CSA, community-supported agriculture, where you have a model of commerce that if it's just the kind of straight-up capitalism where its values are based on price and convenience, then in some cases it actually just won't work. There's a great documentary I just watched called The Real Dirt on Farmer John, and he was trying to make his farm successful. And the farm wasn't successful until he adopted that communities supported agriculture model. So that was in the back of my head as well, where that the community component to it would be central to making the marketplace work.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, founder of Etsy. We'll hear more from Rob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade crafts and vintage items. Rob started the company in 2005 while he was 25 years old, and Etsy has more than 1 million artisans who sell their items on the site. Once you launched Etsy with two of your friends from NYU, did people come immediately? Talk to me about those early days.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember just launching the website, and one of the beauties of the web is you just push a button and it's globally accessible, so you're just kind of sitting back wondering who's going to discover it. And we'd spent an arduous 3 months building it, so we launched it and then just went out to dinner, came home, and I think fell asleep. And then in the morning woke up and saw that a couple people had registered, but no one had put any items up. And then someone opened a shop, someone lists a couple items, a couple days go by, someone bought one of the first items. And that is one of the most amazing feelings, to see something go from nothing to all of a sudden you're connecting people, you're helping people sell things.
What were some of those things that people sold in the, you know, first day, two, three, four, week?
I remember buying a crocheted cat toy with catnip in it, and that was one of the very first items listed. And crochet and knitting have always played a kind of central role to the identity of Etsy. I used to tell people that the name was an acronym for everything takes some yarn.
And you had three cats at the time.
Yeah, I was working at an animal shelter, and just those cats that no one else wants. I'm a sucker for taking those home.
Did you purposely buy a lot of the items from these craftsmen in the early days just to give them kind of this positive feedback that, oh, yes, the site works?
I wish I could have done that. I was broke. I was working for my landlord to, you know, kind of not have to pay rent, and was buying what I liked and what I could afford at the time.
Did you list your own furniture on the site?
Yeah, I listed one of my computers and...
Wait, you're one of your computers or computer cases?
I mean, it was a full functioning computer. Like, I put the guts in it. I wasn't, you know, soldering any of them, but I was assembling the components. So you'd push a button and it would turn on and it was a working computer.
So you put one of your computers on Etsy and what happened?
I charged what I put into it, basically not making any money, but it still meant the thing cost around $1,000. And so, especially in the beginning, it was mainly the lower price items that were selling. So I put it up and it worked great for press because I guess it was a noteworthy design. And so that got picked up. And a lot of that early momentum comes from people writing about what you're doing. And that's been one piece of advice that I've always given to Etsy sellers asking how to be successful is make things worth sharing and worth talking about.
You mentioned you had friends who helped you launch the site and you'd have screaming arguments with these colleagues from NYU.
I would call them loving arguments. And that was Chris McGuire and Chaim Shopik. And still have a lot of love for those guys. That was just us, in some ways, not even knowing what we were getting into. But I remember one time sitting down on the couch with them and kind of putting my arms on their shoulders and saying, what we're about to do is incredibly difficult, but the only reason we have this opportunity to do it is because of how difficult it is. If it was easy, it would have been done, or other people would be doing it better than us right now. Mm-hmm. And going into that together, that type of camaraderie, I think that you have both sides of things going well and things not going well. It's kind of like I've heard some people say when a couple stops arguing, it means the love's gone out of the relationship, where there's always both sides of that.
So people trickled in initially. When did you start getting traction where you thought, wow, you know what, I have something here? Was it a specific person who bought something, or was it just the volume of people who bought something or sold things?
So to me, I've always measured success for Etsy on making other people successful. So early on, looking at how we were measuring that, it was more what people were talking about in the forums, which became the central place to communicate.
What's an example of that?
There are stories of a woman whose kid was really sick, and she was spending a lot of time in the hospital, and she'd been getting really depressed, and she started selling what she'd been knitting, and that gave her this new motivation to knit more. Turning her hobby into a business coincided with, you know, her son being in the hospital and getting better. And you learn about all of these things. And having visibility into that, to me, is this huge motivator. And that's the beauty of the web, is all of these serendipitous connections that can happen.
Your grandfather helped you in the early days. Your grandfather had worked at IBM. What kind of help did he provide?
He was a good sounding board. A lot of his advice I didn't take, for doing the basics of the business side. And I've never been strong in finance, and I've never been strong, you know, even writing the traditional business plan that he was looking for. And the earliest fundraising that I did with Etsy, which to me is the most meaningful, was going to people who I'd built things for and saying, here's something that I'm building, would you like to support it? And those were people who, above everything else, were investing in me. They didn't need a business plan. And, you know, fast forward a couple of years and going out and raising venture capital, completely different game. And, you know, my grandfather was much more used to things at larger companies. And I remember the first investment we got, he said, why would anybody give you money? And then he met with that investor, with Spencer, who's a great guy. And the first thing he said to Spencer was, how would you feel if Rob lost all of your money? And Spencer said, it would sting, but okay. And for my grandfather, that was the prerequisite for letting him invest.
So who was Spencer and why did he give you money? Spencer, and how much did he give you?
Etsy's first two investors were Spencer Ain and Sean Meenan, and then Spencer's brother Judson also invested. I met Spencer because I remodeled the bottom floor of his duplex and built him a bar.
And
he lives above Tower Records on Broadway. And I met Sean because he was opening up Habana Outpost across the street from my apartment where I started Etsy in Brooklyn. And he needed some computers and he wanted to give the whole neighborhood free Wi-Fi. So I remember hanging over the side of his building, installing an outdoor wireless antenna. Those are the types of relationships where once you've formed that, you know, for Spencer, it was, okay, well, you built this bar and I've worked with you, and for Sean, it's you hung over the side of a building for me. And they both ended up investing $50,000 early on.
At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to need more capital than just, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 for this?
I wish we had that type of choice. You know, thinking back, there's a lot I'd like to have done differently about those early days. We hit these walls where we had to scale the site for growth, and we had to go buy hardware, and things like Amazon Web Services didn't exist back then. So I remember the engineer I was working with just saying, we need 20 grand in 2 days or the site's not going to come back online. Those were the walls that we hit where it was really capital intensive and had to go out and raise more money.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy, an online marketplace for handmade items, including furniture, jewelry, and clothing. Etsy cuts out the middleman by connecting buyers directly with artisans who sell items ranging from clocks to knitwear to guitars. Rob started Etsy in 2005 when he was 25 years old. In addition to the early angel investors, who were some of your allies in the early days?
Soon after I launched Etsy, I wrote a fan letter to the founders of Flickr, Katarina and Stuart, who were heroes to me, just asking for their advice. Flickr, the photo sharing website currently owned by Yahoo, and they invited me out to San Francisco and made the rounds out there. They were super helpful. This was back in 2005, so before there were really any web startups in New York City.
Why were you so entranced by Flickr?
The craftsmanship of what they'd built and the sense of community around it. And that was one of the first websites from a design perspective to just cut away all of the cruft and just show the content of the page. And I was spending a lot of time designing Etsy, and that was a big influence on me.
What did you ask for in the letter, if anything?
I wrote them a letter the way a kid throws a penny off a building, you know, not really expecting any kind of reply. And I think it took a couple tries, but Stuart got back to me first.
How did they help you?
First, it was just, you know, there was this world that I knew nothing about. You know, I'm someone who just was meandering my own path out east and then, you know, went to visit them in San Francisco and went down to the valley. And Katarina up front was helpful just kind of saying, here's what I think is good about this world and here's what I think is not so good about this world, and making a lot of really good introductions. And, you know, there was a brief period of time where I was thinking of moving the company out there, but I'm an East Coaster at heart. I need winter and seasons, and so knew that I was going to keep the company in Brooklyn.
At some point, they introduced you to Fred Wilson, who runs Union Square Ventures, a leading venture firm in New York City. How did that encounter go? You said that you were starving for capital, so was venture capital the road you wanted to take?
No, initially we were just looking to do a small angel round, and one way that I've grown the company since the beginning has always been basically take what you need and no more, and spend what you have and no more. Again, this is my grandfather's good influence on me. So, you know, we were going to raise, I don't even remember the amounts, you know, probably $250,000, and we were wrapping that up, and Katarina said, we'll just go meet with Fred, and I had a dinner with him. And for me, and maybe this makes me old school, I don't know, but a handshake will mean more than a contract, and, you know, looking someone in the eyes and connecting with them means more than a term sheet. And found both of those things with Fred, where had a good reputation and definitely understood from a product perspective what we were trying to build. A lot of people at that time, I remember, like, when eBay was starting, people looked at Pierre and said, people won't buy things over the internet. And with Etsy, a lot of people thought, oh, crafty, handmade things, tiny market, that kind of thing. And for me, this was building something that was going to change the way the world's economy worked. Mm-hmm. And he definitely got that. So there was that connection.
When you launched the company, you were the founder and CEO. Since then, there have been some other CEOs that have come and gone, from Maria Thomas, who incidentally was a former employee at NPR, and most recently, Chad Dickerson, who was the CTO of the company, the chief technology officer. And in between Maria and Chad, you were again the CEO. That implies a certain level of turbulence. What's the story there?
So I was the CEO for the first 4 years and knew that there was this swath of business acumen that I didn't have, and in some ways wasn't passionate about. You know, I knew what I was passionate about, which was much more on the product side and the customer support side. So You know, I was always honestly trying to do what was best for the company, and so that first shift was me stepping aside, saying, I think this is what's best for Etsy. So I said, I'm going to focus on the product stuff, and you get to run the business, and tried that out for a while, and that didn't end up working out. And then when I came back, same thing. I said, okay, well, here's what my original vision was. Here's what I think is happening now, and I want to return to that.
How do you feel now not running the company?
It was amazingly painful to go through. I mean, the emotions. It's not quite as bad as having your heart broken by someone you love, but it's also losing your life's work, and for me, losing 6 years of work in one fell swoop. And I lost all of those connections to, you know, the company was 200 people, and those are people I really, really loved collaborating with, and I lost all of that in an instant. And I think in some ways that's just like being in love and having your heart broken. You know, sure, you put your heart back together, but you remember that it was broken. And so to me, understand what it means to be an entrepreneur and be a CEO by having it whisked away from you, you know, by getting booted out of your own company. It's been tough, and I've been rebuilding and thinking about what I want. I've gotten married, expecting a kid, and it feels okay now, but there's definitely still these flashpoints where you think back to the things you wanted to do, you think back to the people that you miss, and it's really hard.
Did you understand why the investors no longer wanted you to be CEO? Or was it going through like anger, denial, you know, those?
Oh, you definitely, yeah, that, what is that? Denial,
like denial, anger.
Yeah, that's very accurate. And you traverse them. I mean, they were doing what they thought was best for the company.
Right.
You know, Fred Wilson wrote a blog post about my lack of management skills. And my biggest regret about all of it was I wasn't given the chance to take their feedback and learn from it. And I'm actually the type of person that really likes criticism. You know, it's going back to art school where you have crits and people come in and they really challenge you about what you're doing. And to me, that's how I get better. Mm-hmm. And never really got that level of criticism from the board so that I could get better. And when I did get the criticism, it was, here's our criticism of you, there's the door. And that was the hardest part for me.
Our producer just told us that it's the Kubler-Ross model of grieving. So denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
I skipped the denial part. And in some ways, I skipped the anger part. And then that came later. I may have to revise this model. For me, it was I felt sorry, and in a way I wanted to apologize to Fred for what I felt like was letting him down. This was someone I'd been working with for years at that point, and on the one hand, have earned him probably around a 50 times return on his investment. But on the other hand, felt like, you know, when you're taking people's money, you're making a pact. And that understanding that I had with the earliest Etsy investors, with Sean Meenan and Spencer and Judson Ain, was that you did right by me and I'm going to do right by you. And we definitely had disagreements along the way. I think Sean at one point threatened to punch me in the face for something I was doing that he thought was really wrong. But throughout those relationships, was always given the chance to show that I could learn. And so it went from that feeling of being sorry to that feeling of being treated unfairly, and this realization that, hey, you know, I generally live my life by treating other people the way that I would want to be treated. And this is a way that I wouldn't treat someone else. And so that led to confusion. And then those give way to anger after that. I remember going home and going to the beach just to, you know, try and clear my head, and just sobbing. And that's still there. You know, you don't ever get over that.
What have you bought on Etsy most recently?
A rocking chair and, I mean, gifts for other people. But also, to be honest, haven't done that much shopping on it since I got the boot, just because it's like going back to your old neighborhood where you got beat up.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing now?
So also, I'm having a kid, and a big challenge for me is build the educational experience that you would want your own children to have. And so I'm starting parachutes.org up in Hudson, New York, and I'm going to be starting a school.
What kind of school?
Unlike any other school that has ever existed, it'll be a one part trade school where, you know, how do you understand what your avocation is? And then one part vocational training where here's how to make a living doing what you love.
What ages?
My preference now is under 7 and over 70. So to have this really interesting juxtaposition of younger people and older people.
What was the impetus for moving to the Catskills from Brooklyn, even though you still have a place in Brooklyn?
I have family from up there, and also thinking about starting a family of my own. Would much rather do that in a place where you can have a better connection to the land and your food and the local community there.
By the way, what does your home look like?
I just found this book in a bookstore titled Handmade Modern, and I was like, wow, that's my aesthetic. So I like the cleaner lines of modernism, but I can't stand the blankness of the materials that they use. And so I like everything from, you know, hand-hewn wood beams to using lots of reclaimed materials and being able to see the imprints of previous generations on those materials that you're using. And so they have, you know, I have flooring that used to be beams in a factory in Pennsylvania and, you know, tabletops that have been made from bridges. And these things have previous lives and that you're working to restore some of their utility after they've moved from one thing to another.
Your wife's name is Layla. How did you meet her? And what does she do?
She designs and makes clothing, and for a lot of musicians, she was working in the same building that Etsy was in, Etsy's first office building. I was learning how to sing and play guitar, and I'd spent about 3 years getting over all of the bashfulness around what it takes to perform for other people. And there was this really cool back stairway in the building that was all concrete, so lots of reverb. And I invited her up one night and got up the gusto to sing to her, and I was like, well, this is either going to end things really quickly or maybe something beautiful can come of it. I guess it went okay. We got married.
What did you sing to her?
Some early traditional stuff, some Bob Dylan stuff, some like early Jim James solo stuff before he did My Morning Jacket. And I was composing my own songs at that point, too.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Rob Kalin, the founder of Etsy. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full-body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And so I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, oh, you know, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago. And I ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How, you know, how old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, well, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a, you know, a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know,
what
Bill's
was
class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people, you know, are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk to a little bit about the music and really, you know, there's a DJ component to it.
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
It's Alicia Keys and Jay-Z.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, great located, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. Mm. And if you would like to have one, it will be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick.
Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling. Water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it, and I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
We put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, this is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free? They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio, and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open and he looked at me and he said, people really come here? And I said, yeah, people really come here and the people that come here really like it. And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that they're a room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's Dad. Impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming, you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, the New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like, you know. Beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning? And we would sit there. And maybe if we got 1 or 2 phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come.
And people really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial. And the,
you know, I told a friend, and they told two friends,
and so on and so on and so on, and it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser. when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And it was
through a rider.
It was through a rider. And she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
He didn't ride. But he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed were going to be would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. You know what? It was a slow news day, and everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue. And we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.